Hello everyone and welcome to another Scots Wi Hae podcast, and today I'm joined by writer Martin Stewart. Hello Martin.
Hello, lovely to be here, thank you very much.
It's an absolute pleasure. We're here to talk about your novel Double Proof, and there's a lot to talk about in it. So how do you describe it to people? How do you describe Double Proof to people?
Do you know, I really struggle at, see that kind of elevator pitch that you're supposed to have is something that really doesn't come naturally to me, because it's something I need to get better at. I then start to go into, I want to talk about his character, or I want to talk about, but do you know, but there's some hidden part of the book. What it essentially is as a capsule of how I described it to myself. I needed something when I was writing it to kind of explain to myself what I was trying to achieve. And essentially that was a more cynical Glaswegian Big Lebowski.
Right.
Was what I was trying to do. And trying to think of that energy and what that would mean were kind of coattails onto which I clung as I was writing. So what we have is, we have a reluctant gumshoe detective.
Yeah.
We have a kind of a reputational stain of having supposedly possessed some psychic powers at some point. We've got cold cases, a hoard of valuable whiskey, and a lot of gangsters. And essentially what I was trying to create was kind of a mess, right, that would then resolve in that very satisfying way that crime fiction can. And that was so I had my Big Lebowski thing, and I also had this idea that almost that kind of, you know, almost like a show not tell, these sort of maxims that you drum into your head.
Yeah.
I wanted this to be fast, funny, and stick the landing. And that was something that I kept as really close to my chest as I was writing. And what I really enjoyed was taking Robbie Gould, this central character, throwing him into an increasing vortex of ludicrous situations, but have that landing stuck firmly and bring it all together. And that's essentially how I roughly describe it to people. And I'm sure my publisher would like me to have a neater pitch for it. But I just like talking about the process of it so much.
Well, we will, absolutely. But that is interesting, because I do think in some ways it's up to folk like me to come up with a description of what it is. But I'm always interested in how writers do themselves, because you've spent such time with the characters, with the premise, with all these things, that it's almost, I would imagine, impossible to come up and go, it's a psychic Glasgow gumshoe or something like that.
Do you know, that was good though. I'm going to steal that, because I need a little bit of that. Yeah, no, I do need more of that. And I think it's interesting thinking about trying to create, you know, a piece of literature on its own merits, but also you're trying to create something that will survive in the market. Yeah. And that's something that just, it's not what we were talking before about, you know, my background as a teacher. And I really do a lot of school visits and things, and I consider myself, you know, I'm a public sector employee in my soul. The sort of commercial aspect of this isn't something that comes naturally to me, and I need more of that, so I'm going to take that one, thank you very much.
I think in general it's interesting talking not just to writers but to musicians and people, you know, who do art in other ways or work in culture in other ways. The thing is making it.
Yeah.
It's not the selling of it, and really that should be down to other people to do, but increasingly it becomes a kind of part of it, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, certainly it's expected of me that I go and talk about the book, and I'll do book events, and you know, I have a kids book series as well. I've written books for children as well, and that comes with a lot of school events.
Yeah.
And I found myself, because I was a secondary English teacher, I've been doing a lot of primary school events recently, which is, I mean, it's great fun, and it's a real, I love having that kind of span. I've written young adult, I've written sort of kind of teenage YA horror, I've done these kids books, and the events there. So I did my first adult event, I'd say adult event, book, you know, book event for adults for,
yes,
Gould in Linlithgow at the Far From Festival. And that was great. It was in the evening, you know, past school time, and we were talking about various aspects of crime fiction and of tartan noir. Whereas, I mean, a few weeks ago I was in a primary school and we're getting questions from the kids, and it's like, oh, where do you get your ideas and all that kind of stuff? And the guy puts his hand up and I said, yes, pal. And he says, can you do a backflip? And I said, no, I couldn't even do a forward roll, but thank you so much for asking.
Yeah.
You know, and so that, having that kind of energy in my life is really great. And to be able to do that and have this, and you know, be talking to adults about it as well, is brilliant. I'm very grateful for that.
I'm gonna nick that one for it. If there's ever I get stuck chairing an event, I'll just go, can you do a backflip? I'm gonna jump a couple of questions in because that's really interesting. I wanted to ask you about the difference between writing children's books or young adult books, and is it just all writing to you, or do you approach it differently?
Do you know what is funny? I wonder, one of the things, because I'm in schools a lot talking about writing and the process, and it means I have to try and reflect on it and sort of codify things that you do instinctively to try and explain them. And that's one of the things, is trying to imagine the process from the point of view of writing 1,000 words, because there's no point in me going in to say, and this is how you write an 80,000-word novel, guys, thanks very much. They want to know how to do it for, in secondary school, like a 1,000-word folio piece.
Yeah,
and trying
sure.
to think about practical tips that means that when you leave, it's actually of some use to them, because, you know, I want to make a contribution to what they're doing within a context that actually has some kind of relevance. And I really like reflecting on things that you do automatically, because so much of it is, I think for me particularly, felt. I know something that I see a lot online is other writers planning their books with post-it notes.
Yes.
So they will take a picture of a whole wall.
I've seen that, yeah.
With and coloured post-it notes and stuff, and I am lost in admiration for it, because then when they're working a scene, they'll peel some off, they'll move them around, and it becomes this quick tactile physical thing. I don't even know where you would begin with that. I have this thing in my head, and I have notes. I take notes and I write notes in notebooks, but it's the act of writing them down is all I'll do with them. I'll almost never go back to them.
Right.
I just record them, and that's something that it's my mind needs me to do.
Yeah.
And then I just work through it, and I have this sort of shimmering, I'm closing my eyes now, I have this kind of shimmering thing that I'm trying to grasp within my mind. And that's something that's really satisfying and can be slightly kind of infuriating. I really enjoy the that kind of sense of working without a net. I think it's something that I hope transfers into the books and makes them quick and sort of vital, you know, and not too kind of mechanical as I think I might be if I overplanned. And in that sense, I think the writing for kids and writing for adults to me feels the same, whether I'm using a different part of my brain or not. I'm really not sure.
Right.
To me, stories are hungry things that need to be fed, and you feed them what they need. And it's, I think, because my first book was a sort of fairly dense kind of soggy Dickensian fantasy, and it was lots of world building and all that kind of thing. And when I finished it, and I really remember finishing it, excuse me, I had written the end, I'd written the last 3 chapters, and so I was writing up to that point, and I remember typing the last sentence that zipped it all together and stepping away from the table. There was no one else in the house. This is me, I'd just moved from teaching full time to just working in the house on my own.
Uh-huh.
Trying desperately not to watch Holmes Under the Hammer, you know. And I stepped away from the table, and there was this sense of, I've done it. You know, I mean, it was this full-length book. I hadn't written anything of that kind of scale before. And having a feeling that, oh, good, and I know how to do this now. I know how to produce a work of this kind of size. And then my next book was something completely different that came with its own rules and internal logic and everything that I had learned previously. It's, I mean, maybe 60% of it was irrelevant, because I had to build a new set of mental parameters within which to work. And I've done every time, because I haven't done a series before, this is the kids' book series, is the first thing I've done where I'm revisiting characters and a context and a setting. I've always been sort of working quite quickly and just feeding the story, giving the story what it needs. And I think in that sense, I haven't felt any particular difference in writing for kids or adults. It's a question of suitability in terms of the vocabulary, which obviously there's some quite choice vocabulary in Double Proof. There's 256 F-bombs, which is cut down from 265 in the first draft,
right.
For reasons of taste. there are none, I'm pleased to say, in the Bridget Vanderpuff series,
right.
You know. And there was never a moment where...
You forgot.
Because I was right. I wrote the first Bridget Vanderpuff book and Double Proof in lockdown. And this was when all my school events had dried up and I wasn't working on anything contractually, so I wrote them both on spec, which was the first time I had done that. And there was never a moment where I went back to Bridget and accidentally had her call her headmistress a prick or something like that, you know. because they're just the stories. As I say, I have these the sense of what they are and of what they can be, the possibility in my head, and you feed that with pace, and it's almost like tasting a recipe. I think it's, you know, it needs something. It's too slow, or it needs a joke, or it's sagging here a little bit, or something. We need a little bit of dialogue, and the balance of the thing just exists as something which to me is quite tangible in my mind. And it's I've already used the phrase stick the landing. It's that sense. I'm sure it was Patrick Ness I heard talking about that the novel isn't the whole thing. It's the performance of the thing.
Right.
You know, you have this in your head,
yeah,
and then you have to do it. You have to get it out there, and you hope that you capture the feeling of what it could be in your mind. And that's the same if it's kids' books, adult books, whatever. And there's obviously a sense that you have to give it away. I mean, I hope it does these things, and you hope that that's how readers respond to it. And that's always really satisfying when you see somebody who's read it who says, oh, it's funny, especially if you're trying to be funny.
Yeah.
If you're trying to make a joke and nobody laughs,
yeah,
that's always a sore one. So if people find the books funny, that means a lot to me, because I'm trying very hard for that to be the case. But I don't consciously do anything particularly different.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I mean, in terms of these two things that I'm working on, I consider Bridget Vanderpuff and Robbie Gould to be quite similar characters, in the sense that they are outside of social constraints. You know, Robbie is very willing to go up straight up to anybody, no matter how scary their reputation might be, and insult them to their face.
Yeah.
Bridget would do the same thing, but say something perfectly pleasant or inquisitorial, you know. And
yeah,
it's stepping out of the sort of boundaries of taste and of how we're supposed to behave was something that was always fun, and that you're doing for both of them.
Yeah.
But in their appropriate context, and with or without swearing.
And I think, excuse me, I think that's really interesting, because you've got protagonists, well, certainly with Robbie, you've got a protagonist where when you're reading it, you go, oh, I'm not sure I would have done that, or
yeah,
I'm not sure I would have said that. And that's part of the joy as a reader, because you're getting, you know, that's where the edge comes in.
Well, I'm really pleased to hear you say that, yeah. I mean, that was, I think, I've been very influenced by lots of comedy over the years, all the stuff that me and my pals watch together. And that would be things like The League of Gentlemen, or like Alan Partridge. Alan Partridge was a big thing when I was at school. And I've heard Steve Coogan talking about that quite a few times. But obviously, because he plays the character, you got to imagine how many times he must have been asked, are you Alan Partridge?
Yeah.
And he has to respond, you know. But he talks about Alan as a version of himself without those social boundaries that we're talking about. So
yeah,
it was a lot of fun. I am nowhere near as cheeky or as physically confident as Robbie Gould. And the thing then that might occur to you to say, you can give to him to say, and it was great fun. And
yeah,
I was really hoping that what I wanted him to do was become the kind of character that we feel that we know, and we know how he's going to respond, which you get with, I mean, you know, in terms of Scottish cricket, you know what Rebus is going to do, because
yeah,
he's such a sort of ornery, chippy character. And even like you think of the stuff that I read when I was younger, so like Granny Weatherwax and the Discworld books, you know, they're cast at a story, you know exactly how they're going to react. And that becomes so fun, because exactly when you get Robbie going into some of these situations, or going to the, you know, the big gangster's place of work, and you're sort of, you hopefully are slightly looking at it through your fingers, because you know he's just going to get himself in trouble.
Absolutely.
You know, which was great fun.
It almost works as a warning, because, you know, if you ever think, oh, I wish I'd said that, but I maybe shouldn't have.
Yeah.
What happens to him when he does say it? You go, no, I was right.
Yeah,
my instincts
no,
were right.
I
all
did the
along.
Right thing, absolutely.
So moving back to Double Proof, are you a big crime fiction fan? Is that, you know, for your first adult novel, was it always going to be crime?
It was. The other day I had been asked it, and I said, you know, I think this is the book I always wanted to write. And that's not true. That really, I think, does a great disservice to the kids fiction that I've done. It was the book I was expected to write.
Right, that's
so something that was when I was starting to read adult books as a younger reader, because I think that the sort of bridging fiction of young adult wasn't around then.
Yeah.
So I remember I read Jurassic Park the year it came out. I was 10.
Yeah.
I've read it since. I must have understood 35% of that book. I mean,
yeah,
it's so much of it was over my head, but I mean, it was quite, I think that's quite important, that, you know, you read things that you don't entirely understand, and it's that's how we, you know, it's how we move on in terms of our vocabulary, and it's thrilling to read something grown up like that.
Yeah, yeah.
What I remember reading was the, I've mentioned Rebus already, my mother bought me the first two, do you remember the big paperbacks you got that had the first three books in them?
Yes.
The big Rebuses.
Yeah, yeah, kind of collections that you would get, yeah.
Massive books. She got me two of those, which the first six Rebus books. And I absolutely hoovered them up without consciously thinking, ah, crime fiction. I just found it really satisfying, the that element of Rebus where you feel that you know this guy. And especially, you know, exactly as you say, he'll do these things where you go, oh my God, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, John, you know. And the sort of chewy genre elements of him falling asleep in his chair, stinking of Lafroig and all that kind of, I think that's so fun. I mean, whether it's, you know, fantasy or sci-fi or anything like that, the horror stuff, genre elements I just always really enjoy, and you play with them and you can subvert them and you bring your expectations to them. But what I really enjoyed about them was that moment where it would seem like this disparate mess of things happening that would be bound neatly at the end, even if it was slightly unfinished, you know, it was all tied in this satisfying knot. And I think the shape of that and the certainty that it provides amongst chaos, to me, explains why crime fiction is so endlessly popular, because we want that. I mean, it's the most satisfying shape a story can have. And it's the most compulsive thing to have, this mystery where you want to know how it's happened. It's the magic trick. How is this done? You know, the pullback and reveal.
Yeah.
So I really like those. I had read Sherlock Holmes when I was a kid. I really remember reading Hound of the Baskervilles when I was, I mean, I'm not sure, 8, 9. Yeah. And being properly scared of the hound.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? And that being quite a visceral experience. And that whole sort of declamatory thing that Holmes has, where just everything is set right, I think that's gone quite deep into my soul. When I was then my late teens, I read a lot of Chris Brookmyre. And I read particularly A Big Boy Did It and Ran Away.
Yeah.
I think four times anyway. And just going back through it, and I loved the sort of cheerful belligerence of what he was doing that felt very recognisably Glaswegian. I liked its Scottishness and its kind of localism, you know, that there would be bits of it that I would recognise, which was always quite thrilling to me. And I think that the sort of validation of Scottishness that I got from those things, like I was 13 when Trainspotting came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I read it at first year in uni, but we watched the film a lot when we shouldn't really have been watching it. And we had the soundtrack on CD and all the. And I think there was something deeply formative for me about what seemed, from my perspective in 1996, to be the coolest thing in the world.
Yeah.
You know, the poster was always in the window of HMV, and it was something that you were aware was a global phenomenon, really.
Yeah.
Was Scottish, and not just like had come out of Scotland or was twee or shortbread tinny, but was so Scottish that, you know, they needed subtitles in the nightclub scene, you know, this kind of thing. So I think was really drawn to the idea of doing something like this. I've spoken to Chris Brookmyre about it a couple of times. I've blown smoke into Chris Brookmyre a couple of times about this, because we played football. I've played in goals for the Scottish writers against the English writers at Bloody Scotland Crime Festival a couple of times. And I would like to mention, I've played three times and I've got three wins. So I'm 3 for 3, which is, you know, it's not insignificant. But I told him about this and how big an influence it was on me, and things, which was a really nice moment. That was, I was very chuffed to be able to do that. But that sort of fast, funny energy was something I always really wanted to do. And it was something that I think, because he was doing so well with it, that also validated my desire to be funny in books.
Yeah.
And I think being funny, he says, hopefully, because obviously, as I say, I'm writing the jokes. You hope people will laugh at them. But everything I've done, I think, has possibly been slightly hard to categorise in the past, because, as I say, my first book was this kind of quite dense Dickensian fantasy adventure with lots of jokes in it. I then did an 80s set, sort of funnier Scottish Stranger Things, which I did right before Stranger Things, and I would like to stress that was the Sacrifice Box, but there was a lot of jokes in that as well, so it then becomes slightly hard. It's the marketing thing that we were talking about. do you market that as a funny book that's also scary, or a horror book, and then fight, you know, so it's really, I mean, I think when you're producing a commodity like this, you can write the story, but when it comes to be turned into a commodity for a shelf, you want to be able to categorise it. And I think my work has slightly been uncategorizable in that sense, from a commercial point of view before. And I think, like say Brookmeyer's work or like Stuart McBride and things, you know, there exists a context for what I think is quite a Scottish voice, which is that happily belligerent, quite macabre laughter in the darkness thing that I think is one of the things that makes tartan noir popular and such a kind of dominant genre in itself.
I think that's really interesting. I think you're absolutely right. I think the success of crime, actually, from the writers that you've mentioned, means that in terms of getting a book on the right shelf, a lot of people are writing crime books, but they're crossing genres. I think it's in such a healthy place at the moment.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, they can be funny, they can be like Doug Johnson's recent sci-fi books. Mm-hmm. You've got a kind of horror. I've just read Philip Miller's The Hollow Tree, which is a Polygon book.
Yep.
You know, that's got kind of horror sides to it. And I think if they're on the crime shelf, they're probably going to get looked at because people love their crime so much. So you can actually, it gives you that space to play around with the genre a bit.
And
I think previously it felt quite rigid, and that's maybe my prejudice. And maybe the way it was marketed, because a lot of the books looked the same, the covers were the same, the fonts were the same, all that stuff. But now I think it's really changed and it's much more relaxed and it allows all these different voices. History, lots of great crime history books coming out, you know, which still feel very contemporary as well.
Yep.
And what I would say about Double Proof is, for me, it's recognisably a Glasgow crime novel, but you do play with that idea and the stereotypes and the expectations there. So you've got gangsters, you've got boxing, you've got, you know, whiskey, all those things, but you've also got influencers and, you know, YouTubers and media hubs and all sorts of things going on. So it's very much, and also you go to places in Glasgow that I'd never read about in a Glasgow novel before. I've been thinking a lot about the Glasgow novel because I reread Poor Things because of the film success and a piece that I'm writing about it. And I thought, this is a great Glasgow novel in the sense that it absolutely celebrates the city as well, and, you know, all sorts of different places. Mm-hmm. Like, we're quite near Queen's Park, and, you know, you've got one of your protagonists' flat round the corner, and you mentioned Newlands. I don't think I've read Newlands in a crime fiction novel before.
I would love if it was the first time.
I think it might be. Was that a joy in itself, to be able to kind of write about the city that you know so well and kind of, you know, celebrate it in that way?
Do you know, it was something I've always wondered about doing and been excited about and intimidated by in the same sort of measure. I mean, you mentioned Alistair Gray, that thing in Lanark where they're talking about Glasgow and it's, you know, Glasgow is a beautiful city, how come nobody ever notices that? And it's, well, no one ever imagines living here. And that sort of, that was, I remember I was talking about that at uni a lot, and we looked at Scottish fiction and Scottishness and its representations and the kind of slight reductiveness that we have about ourselves and that, you know, putting ourselves down, that tongue-in-cheekness and all these kind of things that I think are really interesting. I wonder what makes a Scottish book. I mean, if I had written this book with this kind of energy, and that was something I wanted to do with the first one, the science fiction, if I wrote this about somewhere I've never been, Melbourne, say, but it had this, you know, sort of the Scottish voice, that sarcasm, the kind of I keep saying cheerful belligerence. I don't mean to keep mentioning it, but it's this phrase that's rattling around in my head so much. If Gould's energy and the way that they spoke and all that kind of stuff was transposed somewhere else, and I'm Scottish, would it still have? Does it need to be set in Glasgow to capture that essence? You know, and that's the book. My first book, Riverkeep, was set in a totally made up city, and I really wanted it to be a distinctly Glaswegian novel.
Yeah,
and I hope that it captures some of that. It's a river city, it's a river keep, there's a big city in it that is all, I mean, everything's all fabricated, it's all a fantasy space. But the character's energy and the voices and everything, I wanted to be distinctly Glaswegian, and that was something I was trying to capture. And it was something that, same the stuff that I've read previously, that was important to me. I've never set anything here before. And I had been quite intimidated by it. Everything I've done has been a fantasy setup, or like some of my Stranger Things YA book is set in a town called Hill Ford on an unnamed fictional island, which is basically Arran.
Right.
And that is Brodick and Lumlash mashed together so that the school is in the same place the ferry comes into and all that kind of thing. So I had my cake and eating it there, because I've got the geography in my head. My granny was evacuated to Arran. We always went there for holidays.
Yeah.
It's sort of where my imagination and soul live. But I didn't have to be hamstrung by it. If you want a phone box to be in the corner and there isn't one, you can have it.
Yes.
Here, you're tied to this. Yeah. And you can get it wrong. And if you do get it wrong, people will let you know, and that can be, you wouldn't turn left here to go to, you know, Kelvin Grove Park. That's inaccurate. That's not where the Lobi Dosser statue is. But also, I think more than that, you could get wrong the essence of the thing and the energy that we're talking about being captured in it. And that's, I don't live here anymore. I've lived in Troon. I live in Ayrshire. I'm an Ayrshire boy now. When I talk about going to town now, this is quite recent, I mean going into Troon.
Right.
You know, and that's, I'm not entirely comfortable with that shift. I still think of myself as a Glasgow boy, you know. We've been there a long time now. So I don't know whether enough time had passed that I felt more comfortable coming back with a different perspective.
Yeah.
I don't know.
A distance.
A wee bit of distance. And Robbie Gould lives in Portincross, which is in North Ayrshire, is up sort of between where I am on the way up to Lit Largs, middle of absolute nowhere, really, this, you know, tiny wee place. But that, I didn't consciously do that, and I think it's always interesting to reflect on these things yourself, that I've made him a sort of Glasgow expat living down in Ayrshire, and therefore we get a little bit of that split, I'm sure is no accident, you know. But certainly Glasgow, writing about Glasgow, I found it enormous fun, and actually, to my surprise, having been a little bit intimidated by possibly being, it was a lack of confidence in myself when I started out, you know, writing and publishing books, perhaps that you might be constrained or hamstrung by the fixed geography and the fact of the place. Actually, it's great. It feeds it, because where are you going to go? You know, we're over in Denison, as you say, we're over in Newlands and things, and you know, there's a big fight scene in Battlefield and things.
Yeah.
And this is, when I'm from the South Side, that's kind of, you know, my old stomping ground, getting the bus to go into town and things. And I found it really, really fun. And especially having the voices, because dialogue is so important to me. It's such a central part of how I understand my own process and how I want to tell the story.
Yeah.
And that was quite new because, I say it's quite new. It was what happened in terms of me getting published and unlocking things for me, because I've been trying to get published, started taking it seriously when I was about 19, and it took me 12 years or so. When I was 25, I had written a big fantasy mess of a thing based around a kind of creepy circus, and I'd sent it off hard copy, old school, this is a while ago, you know, still posting stuff hard copy, and the advice I'd been given was that you would get a read receipt on these things by placing in the envelope a stamped self-addressed postcard.
Right.
And so the agency, once they opened your submission, they would chuck that in the outgoing mail, you would get it back, and you would know that X agency had received you. And you didn't hear anything else, but hey, they got it, they had opened it.
Not necessarily read it, but they've got it.
They had got it. So I got one bit of feedback in all the time I was doing that from, I'm sure it was the Artelis agency, because I was so grateful for it. And somebody had scribbled on this postcard on the way to the outgoing mail really fast, "Your dialogue isn't working," and chucked it in the outgoing mail. And I was so keen for feedback that, although that's a bit of a sore one, obviously, I clung to that like the hair of a drowning man.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't have been so, I was so grateful. Thank you. You know, somebody had actually, and it demonstrated that they had read it.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
So I really tried to work so hard on my dialogue, and I read a lot of Alan Bennett.
Mm-hmm.
I read all the monologues, and he's so good at that thing of how people actually speak. You know, that chip in the sugar stuff that he does, you know,
yeah.
Could have been a bookie, you know, all this, just little phrases. And I tried to sort of internalize the rhythms of these things, because what I had been doing previously was being obsessed with world building, because I thought that what I needed to do was build my own version of Middle Earth or Quidditch or whatever, and I would invent a thing, and that would be what somebody would go, oh, wonderful, and they would publish my books. And that wasn't working. And it's much more about character and the dialogue and how they speak, and it's now so central to what I do. And that's become something that I'm a big John Steinbeck guy, mm-hmm. and Elmore Leonard, who is Elmore Leonard, very much of a kind of Steinbeckian school. I know Steinbeck's a big influence on him. And in Sweet Thursday, one of Steinbeck's characters says, "I like a lot of talk in a book, and I don't like nobody to tell me what the guy that's talking looks like. I want to figure out what he looks like for the way he talks."
Right.
And it's all about the voice. And if you have the voice and it feels like something a real person would say, then they are real. And that's the lightning in a bottle, you know. There was another thing of Steinbeck's. My favourite book of his is Canary Row. And it was reading that changed my life, in the sense that it changed who I wrote. And after all this time trying to get published, I got a book deal in a year. And it's in the introduction to Canary Row, and it's Steinbeck's voice. And he's talking about Canary Row, which is this is the 1930s, it's a kind of down at heel coastal cannery town, you know, a fishing town in California. And it's a poem, a stink, a quality of light, a habit, a grating noise, a dream. And how can all that be set down alive? And he says there are certain flatworms that when you try to pick them up, they break and tatter under the touch. So when you're collecting marine animals, you must let them crawl of their own will onto a knife blade and lift them into your jar of seawater. And perhaps this might be the way to tell this story, is to open the pages and let the stories crawl in by themselves. And that was such a light bulb moment for me, because it was like he'd taken me by the shoulders and turned me and gone, no, it's over there. At this point, I was trying to write a sort of sub-Terry Pratchett, very heavily authorial voiced, yeah. You know, the author is present on the page, and I got myself out of the way, and it changed everything. And it became much more about the characters and about what they say and the voices of people in Glasgow. I think people in Glasgow, and we possibly have a bit of a conceit about ourselves as being, you know, it's the people make Glasgow thing. We're all characters, we're all funny, and you know, they'll have the same thing in Liverpool and things.
Of course. I mean,
you know, we all see ourselves as kind of special, you know. But there was definitely something that I was so keen to capture and so enjoyed writing. And that's, yeah, it's a very comfortable place for me to be. Yeah. I found the first Bridget Vanderpuff book really hard to write. It took me 5 years. I wrote and published another book in the meantime. And getting the voice, which I now really have, I really love doing them, but it took me a really long time. This was a totally natural fit. So whatever that means, the voice of a sarcastic Glaswegian prick came very naturally to me. And if the boot fits...
You know. Well, excuse me. A couple of things from that. Dark and funny is almost the way... I don't think just Glaswegians, as you say, but almost... I think that's one of the reasons that Scottish crime fiction in particular it kind of hits a nerve more than anything else. It's because you can be funny, as you said. I mean, few writers make me laugh out loud as Christopher Bruckner does with some of this stuff, you know. And almost like, again, the gasp. You're not supposed to be able to say that in a book, but you can. And the darkness and the comedy together, which is definitely in Double Proof. But also, you talked earlier on about influences such as Rebus and even Sherlock Holmes, and they are character-driven. You don't think about Conan Doyle. You don't think... I've forgotten your bloody name. Rhett Sweebers, that's ridiculous.
Ian Rankin.
Sorry, Ian, my goodness. I'm going to edit that out myself. I just completely went out of my mind. But there you go, makes my point for me.
Yeah.
You know, it's Rebus that you're reading. You don't really think about Rankin as you're reading these books. And so the character, let's talk about the character of Robbie. How do you build such a character? I mean, you've talked about getting the voice. I guess that's vital. You're saying, like, you let the voice lead it and never kind of say explicitly what it looks like. But did you have it in your head what he looked like? Did this character arrive to you, or did you build him?
I think I built him. I think the process of these things, it's really a kind of seed that gets planted in the darkness and gradually becomes mushrooms over time, you know. And it's one of these things that it's not one idea, it's 10 ideas that gradually sort of mulch together and become, you know, take on a slightly unexpected form sometimes. With Robbie, what I have when I'm planning, and I've already, you know, I don't do that I can't do it. I would love to, the post-it note planning thing of all that sort of meticulousness. I have the seed of the story and the germ of the thing that's kicked it off, which is where you hear about something. So I mean, like some, you know, the idea of whiskey. I think I must have read something about a bottle of Macallan being auctioned at Sotheby's in New York for $1.5 million. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, what happens if you find that in your cellar? You know, and it's these kind of things. So that becomes a little seed. And then I have the, not necessarily exactly how it will end. I have a rough sense of how it will end, but more the feeling that I want at the end of the story. The sort of that exit feeling that I'm looking for. And along the way, I've got the big beats, the pillars of the story, which is maybe 5 or 6 things that I know I want to happen and that you're trying to hit. And what it becomes is making sure that your connective tissue takes you there in a funny, entertaining, quick way. And I really like working like that. One of the things I had in terms of Robbie's character, I could read the first couple of pages if you want to.
Yeah, that would be great.
What I was asked the other day...
I've got a copy here. You can.
Oh, thank you very much. I was asked the other day about this when I was in Lithgow. And the other writer, Claire Askew, who was there, had this brilliant explanation for her character and things and where she had come from. And then she read beautifully from her latest book. And I read first because I just find it, as I say, I'm not great with that kind of elevator pitch. And in terms of summing up who Robbie is, this was the first chapter. It's now been swapped with one of the flashbacks to the missing person case that Robbie got involved in 11 years previously. But this is just a couple of pages, and I always had this. When other elements of the story sort of shifted in my hands, I always had this beginning, this origin for Gould as a character. September 2023, 11 p.m. Gould looked outside. The pickup truck was still parked opposite his driveway, Imelda Dale still in the driver's seat. It was hard to tell through the rain, but he thought she'd stop crying. After sorting the recycling, Gould made 2 teas, pressing the bags hard. Blades of coastal night sliced under the doors, and he could hear tiles shifting as the squall hit the roof. He opened the front door, then set the mugs, 1 green, 1 pink, on the sideboard while he cinched up his dressing gown and tied on a plastic rain bonnet. She wound down the window as he approached. Her eyes were red, the warmth that spilled from the car artificial as it hit the salty air. A look crossed her face when she saw the hot drinks. She reached out. Gould held back, slippers on the rooty pavement under the big sycamore. Imelda withdrew her hands. "I told you I'm not interested," he said, taking a sip from the green mug. She nodded. "I told you I wouldn't leave unless you came with me." Gould took another sip. The rain moved up a gear, hissing on the pickup's windscreen and rattling on his bonnet. A swirl moved through the drain, its throaty gurgle echoing round the narrow street. "That's not happening," he said, raising his voice. "Why not?" He made a face. "You're off your head, that's why." "We'll pay you," she said, holding up an envelope. "Well, I told you this morning, I don't do that kind of thing. You did it before." Gould took a longer drink from the green mug, burning his tongue. "I don't know what you're talking about." "Yes, you do. You're Robbie Gould, the psychic crime buster. You went to the police about that wee Paisley girl and they got the guy because of what you told them." Gould held her eyes. "Being psychic isn't a thing," he said after a moment. "That's not how it was." "But you did it. And if you can find her, then..." "I didn't find her though, did I?" Gould shot back. He stopped, settled himself. "You'd already killed her. My son isn't dead. He's..." "I want you to leave," she swallowed. "I'm not leaving unless you're trespassing. This is a public road." "Harassment then? I could call the police." Imelda looked up through the streetlight dappled sunroof, rested her head in the back of the seat and exhaled through her nose. Her hair was scraped into a greasy ponytail and her skin looked waxy and tired. "Why come out here then?" she said, pressing the heels of her hands into her eyes. Gould downed the last of his tea. my program's finished. I always have tea after my program. She looked at him, bare-legged and bulky in his dressing gown, rain bonnet tied over the stubble on his thick neck. Found it in the hedge at the bowling club, he said, falling her eyes. Unbelievable. Can't believe this is my first one. She sighed. Bertie said your mumbo-jumbo might help. Bertie was wrong. Time to go. You helped that family, she snapped, almost leaning through the window. They might not have got that wee girl in time, but her family got her back and they got the man who did it. Why won't you help us? Gould switched the pink mug into his right hand. Because, he said, with a can-you-ever-forgive-me smile, your son is a wee prick who's kidnapped himself to impress some other wee pricks on YouTube, and I'm not remotely interested in being back in the papers or getting bags of shite put through my door. Imelda sagged, then reached for the tea. Gould took a sip from the pink mug. And so I always had that exchange, and I always had this thing where this woman would be desperate outside his house, and he would take out two cups of tea and drink them both in front of her. And it was that moment of realising, oh, he's an arsehole.
He's got a high opinion of himself.
That really allowed me into, like, just, you know, then I know who this guy is. And of course, and my wife would really want me to stress this because I was saying this to her the other day, she said, no, that's not true. He's not a total arsehole.
No.
Apart from anything else, he's our arsehole, you know. But of course, the chipping away at that guard, that this, you know, slight baroque guard of kind of disregard that he has at the start, that's the story. And this, her son, Albie, who, as you say, is this aspirant influencer, and it was great fun being able to pour scorn on that aspect of modern life. And I'm showing my age with that because it's so not my thing. I don't get it. Neither does Gould. Gould's the same age as me. He's 41. Yeah. I was 38 when I started writing this. He was a wee bit older than me. But it's a slow industry, so I've caught him up. So he is, as I am, not native to these kind of things. And although he's totally disdainful of this at the start, in this, you know, very, you know, passive-aggressive, you know, to the nth degree, that chips away. And he begins, he wants, we have to want to find Albie, and yeah, we have to want Gould to want to do it as well. And of course, he does. And that, the harnessing of his better nature is what makes us really warm to him, I think. And we so are on his side as the story goes on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That idea of showing and not telling, again, comes out in many scenes like that, where you're thinking, you know, again, my thing about, I wouldn't have done that, or I wouldn't have said that, or why have you done that?
Yeah.
But what you said at the beginning there about how you switched the first chapter with a kind of flashback, because there's two mysteries going on. There's finding Albie, and then there's what happened with the girl.
Mm-hmm.
What happened with the that made him famous for being psychic, you know. Yeah. What was that about? And I love how that's unpicked as well as you go on, and then it's not really to the very end that he kind of gives an explanation.
Mm-hmm.
And was that, so that switch, was that your idea? Was that an editor's idea to have like the flashback begin the whole thing?
Yeah, that was an editorial suggestion. I had my editor, Alison, and we also worked with another editor called Nancy, who had previously worked with Lee Child. And between the two of them, with Alison Ray at Polygon,
mm-hmm,
who's so vastly experienced in this area, and that was one of the things when Polygon had picked up the book, I was so pleased because it just felt like they really got it. It felt like it was going to a good place. You know, I know, as you see, you know, Philip Miller and everybody else, yeah, Douglas Skelton, all these other folk that they work with. I know they've got Val McDermott coming out in a couple of months. You know, yep. I mean, that's good company to be in. So yes, I thought, oh, good, I'm really pleased about this. So I was keen for her expertise. And then, as I say, Nancy, whose surname I've shamefully forgotten, I'm sorry, who had previously worked with Lee Child and is therefore obviously very experienced in aspects of the industry, which, as I say, don't come naturally to me, you know. They both suggested that we should start with that origin, essentially, because yeah, the book is told over 3 days, and it was deliberately not a murder. It was a kidnapping. And I wanted that. That was in terms of being fast, because I think sometimes with a murder, I suppose it's working with making sure that I could I could achieve what I was looking for, was not being too slow with it. And I think sometimes murders can be gloriously slow. Mm. There's that sort of ruminative thing of, you know, another week passes and we go through the case with the detective as time goes on, and you know, and then your forensic evidence the crime scene is sort of bespoiled over time, and you lose sort of key things, and you know, the time passing is a really strong part of it. I wanted it to be much quicker than that in terms of, for myself, being able to tell the kind of story that I wanted. So it was a kidnapping, because there is a ransom, there is a deadline. And that was as much as anything else. That was to push Ghoul through the story as quickly as possible, but also to act as a kind of sharp finger in the small of my own back to keep going,
yeah.
And to not to be, not to lose myself in kind of slow detail. So that was something that was definitely important. And the 3 days, each of those 3 days has a short flashback to that missing person case that Gould has got involved in. And what's happened is, he has gone to, as Imelda said in the reading there, that's this wee Paisley girl who's gone missing. And he's the psychic crime buster, inverted commas, so-called, because he had gone to the police and told them this theory that he had. And what's happened is that he's gone to the police with a theory that he's just come up with, which was so accurate that they were able to go straight to this wee girl's body. They were able to get the guy who did it. And obviously he ends up then accused of the crime. The papers laud him as this psychic crime buster, and then after when he refuses to do the sort of Mystic Meg lottery predictions for them, he becomes Robbie the Ghoul, and he starts getting, you know, shite through the post, as he says. So it's something that was, it was a sour experience for him, and as a result he's lost everything. He's lost his marriage, he lost his, he was a cub reporter at this point, he's lost his career, he's lost his reputation. He was a good amateur boxer, he was a national champion amateur boxer, packs on a couple of stone, gets knocked out in the ring. This is why we find him at this low ebb, and it's all tied together. And as we go on, these short flashbacks, because again, I didn't want to burden the story too much with too much of that, but just a little bit is enough for us to see that what Gould tells us about what happened isn't exactly what happened. It's not the full story, and it's part of humanizing him and part of, you know, putting meat in his bones as a character. One thing I had expected, because there are essentially three timelines. There's 2023, where the story is happening, September last year. There's 11 years previously with this missing person case that he's got involved with. And then there's 1964, which is when the double proof went missing.
Of course.
And it was a 29-year-old whiskey at that point. It is still a 29-year-old whiskey, of course, because it only ages in the cask. But over that, this sort of 50-year period, it's grown in reputation and value, because it's... And it's the Bigfoot of Scotch. The best whiskey ever produced goes missing for 50 years. Clap your hands together. The Bigfoot of Scotch. And it's worth a lot of money. And so there is a dispute at the heart of the case, which this is Imelda's family. She's Imelda DL. This is a DL whiskey. So as this is about to go to court, her son goes missing. And she reaches out to Robbie for help. When I had conceived of the story, I expected to have a dual narrative.
Right.
Of looking for Albie and finding out what happened in 1964 and as to why the whiskey would go, where the whiskey went and who took it and, you know, what happened there. And actually, as I was writing, I'd said before about, you know, stories to me being hungry things that need to be fed. I just found the story wasn't hungry for that. That wasn't the story, you know. And I think it could have slowed it down so much. Ultimately, what I favoured, and I've done this in other books, another writer once called me a cheat. Because this was with the Sacrifice Box, and I wasn't remotely offended, but I would refute this on the basis that I think you cannot cheat in stories. There are some things that I've, you know, especially like on TV, where you see, therefore, the facial expressions of characters who then turn out to have ulterior motives, but we've been shown this facial expression. There's a little cheat there, or actually it maybe misled you, and they were only making it for the camera. They weren't pretending to other characters.
Yeah.
And they're like, no. You made it look as though, and it's, you can't cheat. Yeah. It's really important that the story has integrity and that the characters have integrity. This was for the Sacrifice Box, which is a stone box that a bunch of kids find in the woods, and they put stuff in it. This is when they're going from P7 to S1, and they make a sacrifice, and they say the rules of the box: never come to the box alone, never open it after dark, never take back your sacrifice. If it seems as though I'm ripping off Gremlins, I am. And it was so fun, because that's, I was talking about kind of chewy genre things.
Yeah.
That's great. You know what I mean? You don't need to read the blurb. Those words are on the cover.
Yeah.
We know someone's going to break those rules. Of course, that's the fun of the story.
And hell will happen.
Yeah, and it was great fun. And, you know, so I'd been asked, there's a bunch of writers, but so what is the Sacrifice Box? Like, where does it come from? I said, oh, I've got no idea. I'm not interested in that. To me, I am these characters. We find this thing, and this is what happens. And it was a more, to me, a more sort of emotionally true way of being able to do it, to have them just dealing with this sort of faceless malevolence and have to negotiate it with them. I don't know where it's come from. That wasn't the aspect of the story I was interested in. It's not part of the resolution. I don't care. Like, it's not, that wasn't the story. I said, oh, you cheating bastard. And I said, oh, you know, excuse me, you know. And that, so it has to be really authentic, and that the immersion of Gould within this didn't demand that he then knew who took the whiskey. Now, actually, as it happens, he pretty much figures it out. Yeah. That doesn't make any difference. He's looking for Albie. He wants to find him.
It's kind of a MacGuffin, isn't it?
A little bit, which is also great fun.
Yeah,
thing to do. I've had some good fun MacGuffins in my story. I talk about MacGuffins when I'm in school, actually, as being a sort of necessary means of kicking off the story, and something that we as readers recognise because it's something that's fun to engage with.
Yeah.
And that's exactly it. It provides the context for the follow the money that is such a classic part of crime fiction.
Yeah.
You know, who's getting rich out of this? That's always the thing. You know, Sherlock Holmes, you think, so this girl has been haunted in a room. Okay, so what happens? She's engaged to be married, and that means her stepfather will lose the monthly stipend her father gave her. Great, so he did it, you know. And when you follow the money, and there's a lot of money in this case, and a lot of people want it, that's exactly what it was. It was feeding it. And I mean, the whiskey thing as well also gave me, I was saying about poking fun at influencers and that sort of, the kind of vacuousness of that. And because I don't understand it. It's just not my thing at all. Whiskey is much more my thing. I'd like a dram. I spent 5 years working in odd bins.
All right.
When I was going through uni and things, and I got very into whiskey there because there was always a lot of it going about. So I do like whiskey, and I like being Scottish, and I like Scottishness. And I mean, I mentioned the kind of shortbread tin thing before. Although that's something to be, you know, kind of slightly sniffed at, I also like it.
Yeah.
All that kind of stuff, you know, the outlet, the silhouette of a stag on a hill. I mean, it stirs the blood. It's good fun, you know. And I don't think there's any reason to be ashamed of that kind of thing at all. Having said that, the whiskey industry is quite a puffed up entity.
Oh yeah.
And I'm talking about marketing and producing commodities. The whiskey industry has done that very well, and that's Gould said at one point. You know, it's his pal who runs the Good Spirits Company, which is a real shop. We had the launch for this there a couple of weeks ago, because I used to work for one of the guys that owns it in Odbins, Matthew McFadgen. So we had a launch in there, and I'd asked him if I could put the book in the shop, because I needed some whiskey expertise, and in terms of the pace of the story, I didn't want to send him up to Glengoyne or up into Highlands to the distillery. It was better if it was in Glasgow, and it's on back, and it used to be 23rd Precinct.
Yes.
So it's got the kind of bones of the city in it, which it was a great thing to be able to do, and they allowed me to put the book in, which was great. And the guy in the shop said, he's asking him about the double proof. He said, can you not Google this? And he said, I have. He said, it's all shite about the spirit of the Highlands and Braveheart and all that. And there's something about it that is, for something that's supposed to be so authentic, this is the Ishgaba, you know, it's our blood. It's so inauthentic because it's all, everybody's special. They've got, these are the tallest mainland stills. Because the one in some of the islands, they're taller, but these are the tallest mainland stills.
Yeah, yeah.
Our barrels are the closest to the Atlantic of any distillery in Scotland, whatever it is.
Salt is coming in.
It is the Atlantic foam will be in your, you know, in your breast, you know. And it's, I really like all that, but it's ripe for parody, I would say.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, one of the things, Gould has a nip up at Lock 27 when he's waiting for a drug dealer. Who's walking.
Another place I don't think I've read in a crime novel.
I'm really
novel.
Pleased about that as well. He's waiting, the drug dealer walks his miniature Dachshunds there, so he's waiting for him, and he has a nip of Malt of the Month. And the tasting notes in the back, I tried to make deliberately nonsensical. And as he reads them aloud, it finishes with a note of pickled pineapple, and Gould's going, Jesus, and he has a nip of this thing. Oh. So he washes it down with coffee. And actually, we had three whiskies at the launch night, and by sheer chance, one of the second whiskey, which was a sort of specialist bottling that the shop has, it's its own cask of Old Pulteney. It was a 55% cask strength, and it opens with aromatic notes of tinned pineapple. And I thought, that's great, because it's just, that's exactly what it was. And do you know, hey, you could smell it. I mean, it was there. But I love the sort of the nonsense of it was something else to get really stuck into. And if, you shouldn't. It's the same as, like, I was quite inspired by Harlan Coben's Myron Bolitar books. You know, it's like Myron, he gets involved, there's a murder at the golf tournament, or, you know, yes, the US Open tennis, or whatever it is. Uh-huh. And you're dipping a toe into these worlds, but it's not a golf book.
Yeah.
It's a crime book, you know. And that's, it's the same with this. You shouldn't. That was, it was a kind of guiding principle. You should not need knowledge or, you know, an interest or an enjoyment of whiskey to get anything from this book at all. And yeah, of course, Gould going in as an absolute wine drinking cynic, is he's the best person to take us into this world, because he's not into it, you know, and therefore we don't have to be. Yeah. You know?
And I, the other thing I thought is, whiskey is popular. I know, I did an interview a long time ago with, it was for the Glasgow Film Festival, and a guy had whiskey and journey, or from glass to, no, from grass to glass, or something yep, like that yep, it was. And it's been the most popular YouTube video I've ever done. And I think it's just folk go whiskey. It's yep, a massive, massive selling point.
Yeah, absolutely. Which, yeah, I mean, you would think I had done cynically as yeah, a marketing ploy. I really didn't. I just, it's just, it's something I'm interested in. And yeah, I thought it was a good, fun way to get into as a contemporary Scottish voice,
yeah,
to have that traditional stuff. And this is Albie. I mean, he's the boy who's gone missing. He's an influencer, but he comes from an old whiskey family. And yeah, part of what he's built his reputation is with his YouTube channel, of pouring three grand bottles of scotch down the sink yeah, and things like that, and really sneering at this kind of lineage that he has. And I think that it's the kind of classic Scotch dichotomy of being proud of the shortbread tin, but also wanting a more contemporary, urban and sort of vital and relevant image. And I've tried to, there's quite a lot of splits in the book, which I think is something classically Scottish. He's living down in the coast in Ayrshire now. He's back in Glasgow. We've got that sort of that modern and the traditional at war with itself, and the image of Scotland yeah, as a beautiful place, with also that classic sort of seedy underbelly, which is so fun to visit, you know.
Yeah, no, I think that's lovely as well. You're breaking out from the traditional crime venues, if you like, which might be the East End pubs or whatever it might be, to, you've got, you know, a lovely flat in the south side, you know, bought on the on crime, basically, yep, you know, funded by crime, which overlooks, you know, the tennis courts.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got these kind of, as yeah, you yeah, say, yeah, changes. Just to go back to that, having the opening bit as a flashback, it's such an interesting thing for me as a reader who didn't know anything about the book before I read it. And so it begins like a different novel.
Yeah.
It begins like it's going to be about this crime from back in the day.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've got these two, are they both policemen?
Yeah, so that's the police sitting in the car.
And I thought that is
going to
be their story.
Yeah.
You know, and these are, I mean, they're characters. You only get a little bit of them, but you yeah, go, I'd like to know more about them yeah, and what their story is. And then that's such an interesting thing to then jump forward and, oh, okay, this is who we're following yeah, from that opening bit.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely something that I wanted to avoid doing. Partly for myself, I didn't want to be too bogged down in research. And as I say, I wanted that kind of gumshoe Big Lebowski tradition of just a sort of outsider being pulled through this. I know, I mean, we've talked so much about Rebus today, but it was something that was a real, you know, a real building block for me early on. I've heard Ian Rankin talking about various aspects of Lothian and Borders police that then had to bleed in. You know, he's
yeah,
Rebus is then bound by the structure of uh-huh, even though he puts himself outside of it a lot of the time, it still exists.
Yes.
He still gets hooked into fetus every so often to get roasted by the farmer, you know. That you need to know what that is. I don't know anything about that. You
yeah,
know? And that's not, it's not my world. And again, I wanted to be able to do it authentically. So I definitely wanted him to be outside of the police. And I think you're right. I think it starts as though it's going to be more of a kind of, not even more of a traditional. I think it's just, I don't think that applies. Now, you were talking about how contemporary crime
yeah,
just spans all of these things.
Yeah.
It just seemed as though it was going to be a slightly different thing. And I hope that sort of, there's a kind of dissipating release of a different kind of tension when you then go to Gould and he's tying a rain bonnet on, you know,
yeah,
and it's, so there's a sense of it subverting a certain type of book that will be maybe more along the kind of procedural lines and more within the establishment. Because definitely that was something that I didn't want to, I also didn't want to get wrong. That
yeah,
was it. I
yeah,
mean, I don't know that. You know, I can, what's in here, there's so much of this. I mean, I've never gone in and excuse me, been dragged into a gangster's torture chamber.
Yeah.
I'm imagining it, and it's, I want the play of it. This was, lockdown was a, a strange and challenging time for all of us. My son was 5 months when the first lockdown kicked in. My wee girl was three about a week after that. So we're a three-year-old and a five-month-old at home, stuck at home, and it was, you know, we're trying to work in the house and things. And also professionally, because as I say, I published my third book, which came out in the States, Canada and the Philippines during lockdown. That came out in 2021 without really much of a whimper, because that's what it was. It was just, these were the environments, and I didn't have anything else on contract. So sort of in a kind of professional, existential way, it was a bit worrying. And I really wanted this, the Double Proof and Bridget Vanderpuff, which I wrote at this almost at the same time. I would then finish and edit on one and go back to the other. And it was really important to me that I enjoyed it as much as possible. Yeah. And so the play aspect of this, there is something slightly overblown and sort of John Wayne's Six Shooter with 100 bullets about Gould's physical tenacity.
Yeah.
If we were to film this, and I should stress that the rights are still available, and that it's got BBC Scotland written all over it, I would say. If you gave him literally every injury that happens in the book, I mean, he's put through a real cheese grater.
He's
know,
like
and
the
that's...
knight, you know, it's not just a scratch.
It is but a scratch, yeah, exactly. No, it isn't. He just keeps going. And I really enjoyed that. I just think it's so fun. And you know, the everything to me, I heard David Mitchell talking about this. This David Mitchell of 8 out of 10 Cats, not David Mitchell of Cloud Atlas fame.
Right.
Although David Mitchell of Cloud Atlas, I've got a quotation from his Desert Island Discs, which starts my presentation to senior kids when I'm at school about art, not being kissed by the muse. It's about discipline and thoughtfulness. So he's also important to me. But David Mitchell of 8 out of 10 Cats was being interviewed, and he was saying that he believes that if something is funny, it is just automatically superior to another piece of art which is the same but isn't funny. And I completely agree with that. I think it's I'm not saying it's easy to write, you know, some sort of hard-hitting thing, and I'm not saying that it's that, you know, it's a superior form of the craft or anything like that. To me as a consumer, I so much prefer when things are funny. Yeah. I think life is funny. I think if you're going to write honestly about life in any way, it has to be in some way funny, because I think even if you think about like describing a good time with, you know, in the company of your friends, you would say, do you know, we had a good laugh, like know, that was a great laugh or whatever. I mean, it's, you know, laughter is, it's such a currency, and when you spend time around kids who are, you know, unburdened by, I don't know, mortgage rates and whatever, they just laugh all the time. It's great, you know. And I think that you were talking about the sort of the kind of laughter and the darkness thing, I'm sure this thing, like, League of Gentlemen was a really big influence on me when I was younger. And that thing of the laughter coming from the scary or unpleasant or grotesque thing. It's not that they sit side by side. It's that they are one and the same. Yeah. I'm sure it became part of my kind of creative DNA at that moment, because it was a really big thing for my pals and I. but in the likes of, I mean, it's a really personal example. I lost my mother 7 weeks after my wee girl was born, my first child. So it was a very, very suddenly, a real head-spinning moment. And she and my brother were in the hospital. She went into hospital on the Thursday, and we lost her by the Tuesday. It was really, really quick. So it was like the Monday afternoon. She's in the room just with my brother by herself, the two of them. And they're chatting. We're waiting for the explanation of, you know, and this is what your kind of prognosis and timelines and all that kind of thing. And my mum says to my brother Graham, well, we know it will not be as long as we would like. And Graham says, you don't know how long we would like, which was such a good line, you know. And they both really laughed, and it's like, that is as bad as your circumstances can be. And I mean, this is it's not that it's the threat of bleakness. The bleakness has arrived, it has come, here we are. But there's still, you know, we're human beings. That's how we respond to things.
Yeah.
And whether I don't think that can be particularly Scottish. I'm sure that
no, I think that must be a universal.
It's the human condition, and I think that the idea that we have of ourselves as, you know, when you think of Tarte Noir, as being particularly able to access that kind of laughter in the darkness. I'm sure there are parts of, I don't know, Eastern Europe where that, you know, that have been through various challenges and keep still. You think of, you know, like I've been to Poland a couple of times, the people seem really similar to Scotland to me. You know, it's, you know, there's an energy that you can feel. I think possibly, you know, Tatinwa, we owe a lot to the kind of being part of the dominant cultural idiom in the sense of translation balances between English being translated into other languages, you know. And I think we're a beneficiary of that, and that's why it's become this such a dominant thing, for which I'm very grateful of being able to harness. But yeah, the comedy and Gould is a very wounded man. I think he's desperately lonely and very, you know, emotionally injured, which is something that gradually reveals itself, although he would reject utterly, because of course he is absolutely fine and would have no truck with that whatsoever. That was his comedy as a response to that, and the constant delivery of funny lines as a means of coping with that seemed to me something that wasn't applied just to try and get laughs, but was an authentic way of exploring his character and of making him seem like a real person.
Yeah, and as you say, he's gone through all these things since his brush with fame, if you like, and you know, it's that thing, well, you know, you might as well laugh, because if you don't, you'd be crying.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Are there going to be more crime books? Are there going to be? Can you see?
I hope so. I mean, listen, because I had written this, as I say, on spec, so the draft was fit. This was new to me. I had written stuff before. My first book deal came from a short story I had written when I was off work after knee surgery, and Penguin had bought 4 pages of a short story to turn into a full-length book, which was very back to front and was an interesting creative challenge, because I didn't have very long to do it. I had about 4 months to put it together. And then, you know, I got a book deal again on a sample for my second book. That was 3 chapters. They signed it up, and so I was writing to order, essentially. These I wrote on spec. So I had this finished draft and it went off, and I got a 1 book deal for it. So I have lots of ideas. I mean, Robbie is, we've talked about him a lot as a character who I feel I know, and I think by the end of the book, we know him, and my hope is that you would be able to see him going into lots of different scenarios, and that is exactly how I envisage it. There are an almost infinite number of contexts into which I could send him. You know, you turn the key in his back, and off he goes with all his chippy, wide-o attitude. You know,
an understanding of how his mind works, and therefore how he would approach these different situations, but still, you're going to find out exactly how it all unfolds.
Exactly. So that's it. So, I mean, you know, you've talked about it already, that thing of where you realise these are the circumstances into which he's going, you would be going, oh my God. Because you know just how much he's going to stir things up.
Yeah.
And it's one of his principles is that this isn't actually in the book, this is just one of the ways in which I understood him, is that, you know, as a keen and skilled former amateur boxer, there are different ways of boxing. Sometimes you crowd your opponent, you really get in his face. Sometimes you step back, let him tire himself out. And this thing of, his brother says to him, you know, it's like your superpower. Uh-huh. It's getting on people's tits, you know. And being able to have him do that in lots of different contexts. I have sent a couple of those that I thought would really work to my agent, who I know has forwarded them onto Polygon. So this is my come and get me plea for more Robbie Gould.
Well, I can say as a reader that, you know, that's exactly, I want to see him in more situations where he's pissing people off, because what comes from that is kind of glorious by the end of it. Yeah. Martin, thank you so much for
taking the
time to talk to me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Wonderful. No, thank you very much for your time. I'm glad that you enjoyed the book, and thanks so much for chatting to me today. I could do this all day. Great fun.
It's an absolute pleasure. And we'll be back soon with someone completely different. Cheers.